No, but Ermil is a renowned speaker, a student of the Vedic understanding, Bhagavad Gita, and so on, and a very, very powerful orator also, who also has a PhD in education, and is involved in various different projects which are linked to the propagation of the sharing of the Vedic understanding with various groups of people internationally. Mother Ermil is also an author and has a new series of books for young people that's coming out soon, if I'm correct. And she was
very
also
young people,
very
like
young
people. About this height.
And she was also one of the people involved in putting together the curriculum for the first Hindu school in the UK, which is a Krishnavanti school. And so we're very honored to have her here. I've heard her speak many times, and I'm sure you'll find that she's a very, very amazing speaker who has a great depth of knowledge and realization in terms of the Bhagavad
Gita. Now, if you're going to give such a high introduction, then they're never going to, no matter what I do, I'm never going to live up to this one.
So, I'm very honored to have her here, and she's here to speak about today the principle of karma on the base of the Bhagavad Gita, and also the understanding of duty as enunciated in the Bhagavad Gita as well. So,
okay, it's nice to be here, Ernston Young. It's April 12, 2010, here in London. Actually, my degree is not just in education, it's in educational leadership. So it's really educational management degrees. I have an MSA, which is like an MBA, but for schools, and then my PhD is in educational leadership. So we also study things such as finance, human resource management, leadership principles, not just how to make out whether the letter's a C or an S. Can you all hear me well? Can you hear me all the way down there? All right. Excellent. Is it? Okay. Wow. Thank you. Water and glasses. Everything. So the word karma literally means work or activities. And the science of karma can indicate to us whether or not our activities will bear the kind of fruit that we would like. So, of course, there's major life decisions. You know, what do I study? What career do I have? Where do I work? What kind of work do I do? Who do I marry? Where do I live? And we make these decisions based on whether or not we think they're going to bring us happiness, satisfaction, meaning, connection, joy, peace, power. We have certain things that we hope to attain. So let's think, is it possible for me to get some water?
Still a sparkle.
Oh, it takes sparkle. So just like if you want to go someplace, first, you need to know where you want to go. That's the first thing. And then you need a good map. Thank you. Just like when we were driving here, a little bit of a hard time because the building was behind another building. So we weren't quite sure where we were going. And because we weren't quite sure where we were going, it was very difficult to get there. We weren't sure, are we here yet? Is this the right place? Have we arrived? So when we have our activities also, we need to know where are we going. Otherwise, one is not sure whether or not one has arrived. You don't just go to an airport and say, I want a ticket somewhere. And often people are doing work without knowing what they hope to achieve by that work. Therefore, it's very hard to gauge success. Then the second thing is, once you know where you're going, one needs to have some map as to how to get there. And if you have a lousy map, then even if you know where you're going, you won't arrive. Let's look for a moment at what we're trained to believe is success and the path to get there in modern industrialized society. So generally, they're telling us that our achievement, our success, our goal is money, status, perhaps doing some good for the world, a comfortable life. And they're telling us that the way to get there is to have a good education from a prestigious school, have a good job where you make a lot of money, and you have a lot of status in society. It's interesting that sociological research shows that once you have the basic necessities of life, more and more money doesn't add to your happiness. Interesting, isn't it? Just ordinarily speaking, happiness. The main thing that makes people happy. Anybody guess what's the main thing that makes people happy?
Love.
Yeah, good relationships. That's much more of a contributing factor to people's feeling of happiness and satisfaction and meaning in life than how much money they have or what kind of work they're doing. So we really wonder whether modern society is even telling people what the right address is. And then how do you get there? Well, if you don't have the right address, how you get there is irrelevant. But if you figured out that the right address is you want things such as happiness, knowledge, satisfaction, meaning, security, does a modern society actually provide that? Are they providing the proper map? Now, what's really interesting is that if you get higher up into the realms of sociological research, the scientists, the professors will be very honest that we haven't the foggiest notion how to achieve those things. We don't even know if the world that we perceive is what we're perceiving. When you start getting into courses on the philosophy of research and the philosophy of science, people discuss things such as, is this really a table? You might say, well, that's kind of a stupid question. Of course it's a table. But I'd like to ask you, how do you know that this table is real and the table that you see in your dream is not real? What's the difference between the table? In your dream, you can feel the table, right? So how do you know that this table is real and your dream table is not real? I know it's been a long day. You've been working really hard. You're conscious? I'm conscious when I'm dreaming. I'm aware. I have some kind of awareness when I'm dreaming. Right. Because if I dream about you, you don't have that same dream. If I say to you, hey, I had a dream about you, you have no recollection of it. Whereas we all say, oh yeah, there's a table and it's kind of beige and it's this size. It's a collective experience. And because it's a collective experience, we call that reality. Is it possible to have a collective experience that is not reality? Do we all have experience of collective experiences that are not reality? What about movies? I mean, they're real in the sense that something's happening. But can you sit in a movie theater with a few hundred people and everybody experiences that somebody's jumping off a helicopter or buildings are burning or whatever, and none of that's really happening? I mean, something's happening. There's lights on going on a screen, and at another point in time there were actors. All that's happening at that point in time is lights going on a screen. But you know, in a dream there's also something happening. There's electrical impulses in the brain. It's not that nothing's happening. So that's a collective experience. But it's not the reality. Or many people playing a computer game. That's a collective experience. And people even talk afterwards, yeah, I saw you at such and such place and we were doing this thing. So how do we know that this is a table? We don't. We don't. This could be some kind of giant computer game. And the fact is, we don't know. And the scientists and the professors who do research, once you get to higher levels of study, they'll tell you, we don't know. We don't know that what we perceive is what is reality. And of course, although we can all have a pretty similar description of this table, we're not all going to have an identical description of this meeting. I'm sure you've all experienced that in your life. You have a conversation with someone and they walk away with one impression of what happened and you walk away with another. no two people are perceiving the world exactly in the same way. So whose perception is reality? And there's actually a list of things that are defective about our perception of reality. For example, many different stories can be made about the same facts. That's why in crime, you know, they may come up with one story that explains a crime and it might be wrong. Put the wrong guy in jail. Find out later. No, really, it was something else. And facts themselves don't suggest any particular interpretation. Most of what we're considering reality is our interpretation of the facts, not the facts themselves. So we can have a list as to how we're really not sure that the way we're perceiving reality is reality. But if that's all we have to go on, what kind of map can we devise in order to achieve our destination? You can't. If I'm looking at London and I'm not really sure that the streets that I see are the streets that exist, how can I give you a map? And what's worse is we don't even know what thing, we don't know if anything we perceive is what it really is, an objective reality. And we're not sure, are we perceiving some of objective reality? None of it? If we're perceiving some of it, what part are we perceiving that's real? So here we are looking at the world, trying to draw a map. This is how you get to your destination. And I know the map is not, I know it's not correct. But I don't know what parts are correct. I don't know what parts are wrong. I have no idea what the percentage is. So simply through our senses and logic, we cannot say, this is a path to success. I can't even say it's 90% sure. It's 10. I have no idea what to what extent I'm able to perceive the world as it is. And then we can ask, people by following the way of living of modern society, have they achieved more happiness, security, peace, friendship, meaning? Are we arriving at the destination? Well, maybe we really have, seriously, a wrong map. So if you want a good map, the best place to go to is the city planner. And therefore, there are, throughout the world, many different scriptures that say, this is the way the world works. This is how it's designed. This is what will take you to the destination, and this is what won't take you to the destination. If you have a lousy map, you may end up in a very different neighborhood than you intended. Has that ever happened to you? You end up in a very dangerous neighborhood. It wasn't quite where you intended to end up. So that's what often happens if you don't have accurate directions. It's very sad and lamentable that in modern society, the people who are guiding us, what kind of education we should have, what kind of job we should have, what are ethical norms of behavior, frankly admit, at least at the higher levels, that they don't know what they're doing. They frankly admit it. They don't know what they're doing, and they don't even know what percentage of what they're doing is in tune with reality. Although they don't make that obvious to people in general. So the Bhagavad Gita teaches what is, first of all, what is the goal? And then second of all, what is the proper map to achieve it? And therefore we can make good decisions that will get us to our destination. So the Gita is saying that the goal is happiness, knowledge, actually unlimited happiness. In the sixth chapter, it says happiness without a border. Most of our experience of happiness is very much bordered. It's bordered by quality and it's bordered by time. We have a life with moments of happiness that have a beginning and an end. And the quality of the happiness is not unlimited. It's usually limited to some of our senses or just to the mind. It's not involving everything in a holistic way. Certainly very rarely. And we would not say that we have happiness without limit. It's also saying that the goal is knowledge, to be illumined with knowledge, and the goal is freedom, and the goal is complete security, being in a position where one has no fear of any kind of harm. So many people mistakenly think that a spiritual path involves no action. It involves removing yourself from society, maybe going to the Himalayan mountains or going to some monastery on the top of a cliff, just engaging in prayer and meditation, maybe not even speaking to anybody, eating just old bread and soup, you know, wearing uncomfortable clothes, putting rocks in your shoes, removing yourself from anything to do with the world in order to achieve unlimited happiness and knowledge and total security and meaning. But that's not the message of the Gita. Although such a path is described in the sixth chapter, the path is described and then, for most people, rejected. The path is described in the Gita. It's given throughout the Gita, but one of the verses I like the best is in chapter 8, text 7, where Krishna, who's speaking to Arjuna, who's a soldier, he says, Mam manusmaram yujyatcha. You think of me and also fight. Do your work, but do your work in transcendental consciousness. Change the consciousness of your work. So we could say that there's three main ways of acting in the world, which will bring you to different destinations. One is called karma, one is called vikarma, and one is called akarma. And each of them gives a different result. The word karma literally means activity or work. But in this sense, karma means activity or work that's in harmony with reality. You can think of it just like this room. We have this whole wall that's made of glass. But within this wall, there's two doors. So karma means you want to go in or out of the room, you use the door. Vikarma means you try to go out through the glass wall. So you're still moving, and your destination is outward, but you're trying to go through the wall, and the only result is that you bang your head, and you become frustrated. So we'll first look at karma and vikarma, then we'll look at akarma. So karma basically means activities that, as I say, are in harmony with the world, with reality, where you're working with the real map. You're going through the door that exists. People might call them pious activities. I don't like to use words like pious and sinful because I think they've been really ruined in modern society. They sound like some sort of rule book that some nasty person, well, these are good things, these are pious things, and these are sinful things. But if we think of piety as something that's in harmony with reality and sinful things as something that's out of harmony with reality, something like whether or not I want to drink the water or do I want to try to eat the cup. So something that's pious is something that's natural and in harmony with reality. And something that's sinful is something that's false or against reality. Then akarma is activities that look like normal activities, but they're on a platform of full freedom. They go beyond bringing you the limit of material happiness to actually unlimited happiness. And they go beyond the limit of bringing you a sense of safety in the world to bringing you unlimited safety. A feeling of unlimited security and peace. At the same time being full of excitement. A safe adventure. Akarma is a great science. So before we go into what constitutes them, we can say that the kind of work one does, whether karma, vikarma, or akarma, determines, first of all, who we are. So each of us in this life has a particular identity. So like in this life, I'm a white American woman. Did you say I was from America? They all figured that out after 5 minutes of my accent, that I say job instead of job. Who we are, what country we're born in, whether we're male or female, what we look like, what kind of education we get, how much money we have, what kind of family we have. So who we are, what we experience, whether we experience sickness or health, whether we experience poverty or wealth. And this work is basically, it's like, what do you say? It's building our self-concept. The work we do feeds particular desires, it feeds particular thoughts, a particular mentality, and then it develops a particular body. So it's explained in the fifth deep chapter of Bhagavad Gita that we get a particular body, a particular group of senses grouped around our mind. So whatever position our mind is in, especially at the time of death, as explained in the eighth chapter, then we get a particular body that suits that mind. Like you get a particular office, you get a particular situation, depending on your mentality. So our activities, our karma, is very much related to our internal desires, and it controls everything that's around us. You could also say karma or work is functioning on two levels. It's functioning on the level of our internal motivation, our mood, and then also our activities. So action is on two levels. What is our motive? What is our mood? What are we trying to accomplish? And then what are we doing? I think that's a clear thing. It's understood, for example, in crime. If you kill somebody, your motive for killing the person determines what level of crime it is, right? If you just foolishly put a plant on your windowsill and it fell out and knocked somebody on the head, that's just manslaughter. And if you plan for months to kill somebody and shot them in cold blood, that's first-degree murder. So it's not just the action, but it's also what motivated it. And that's true for good deeds also. You know, if I give you a lot of money because I just love you and I want you to be happy, or if I give you a lot of money because I'm thinking, well, if I give you money, then I can control you to do this and that, and I can come and say, well, you know, I gave you that money, so now you got to do this. Well, I gave you that money, so now you have to do this. Do you ever meet people like that? I was one time in someone's home as they were talking about redecorating their front entranceway, and the man's mother-in-law was there, and he was looking at different colors of paint, and she said, no, you can't use that color paint. And he said, why not? She said, because I lent you the money for the floor. I get to tell you what color paint you use. So he didn't borrow any money from her again. So it's not just what you do, whether it's good or bad, but it's what's motivating. Both of those things together determine whether it's karma, vikarma, or akarma. So karma means that you're working according to the laws of the universe. And this is described especially in regard to four different categories. In the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about four categories, although in other sacred literatures, such as Bhagavatam, we look at eight categories. And those four categories are categories of occupation, which in Sanskrit are Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. And these four categories determine what's considered karma, what's considered activities that are in harmony with reality and will bring you positive results. So the activities for a Brahmana are things like study, austerity, peacefulness, religiousness, self-control, worship, teaching. We can think of the Brahmana who in modern society would be the intellectuals, the scientists, the philosophers, the professors, the religious leaders, that the essence of their karma is to be protectors of truth and ideas. Then there are the Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are, in the olden days, they were royalty. Today they're politicians. Anybody who's in, or landlord even, on the lowest level, they'd be a landlord. Someone who owns property and gets their money through rent or taxes. So a mayor, a governor, prime minister, president. And the essence of their karma is to protect people. to make sure that people have all proper facility for their material and spiritual life. And they're supposed to have great honor and courage, righteousness, and such people have a natural mood of leadership called in Sanskrit Ishvara Bhav. Bhav means a mood. They have a mood of being a controller. Then you have the Vaishyas. Vaishyas are the people in the society who generate wealth. So the essence of their karma is to generate honest wealth and to protect the main sources of wealth, which are the land and animals, land, water, animals. Then you have the Shudras. The Shudras are the assistants, the laborers, the workers, the artisans, the entertainers. And their main karma is to protect things. So since here you're all dealing with wealth, I think we'll concentrate on the Vaishyas and look at what is the karma of a Vaishya. So if we think about what is wealth, where does wealth come from? Society needs wealth. Society needs truth. Society needs good people. Society needs assistance. And society also needs wealth. So what is real wealth? Real wealth mostly comes from the land and the sea. Land, sea, and animals. If you think about all the major sources of wealth, maybe some of them come from the air. I think most of the sources of wealth come from the land, vast majority from the land, quite a few from the water, and then from animals. Practically everything that we consider wealth comes from land. If you think of all the mineral deposits, gems, the soil itself, all the agricultural products, building materials. So the karma for a Vaishya is to only generate real wealth, not cheating wealth. A lot of what happens in modern society is a lot of what's called wealth is not really wealth at all. It's imaginary. It doesn't really exist on any platform. It's just numbers. It's numbers which the meaning and the value of them can change from day to day. It doesn't really correlate to anything substantial. Just like, I don't know if you have that term here, but in America we call land real estate. It's real. It's genuine wealth. So the Vaishya's duty is to make sure that the wealth is real wealth and to protect the sources of wealth. The Brahmanas are to protect truth and ideas and philosophy, the Kshatriyas to protect the people, the Shudras to protect things, and the Vaishya's to protect wealth. After all, you want to have that source of wealth go on for generation after generation after generation. Therefore, the main sources of wealth have to be presented honestly and to be protected. Of course, we see that that's not what's happening. There's something quite different that's happening. Wealth is being generated dishonestly, and the sources of wealth are being destroyed. Of course, this is happening at every level. So we have the professors, the scientists are distorting truth. Like I was saying, you get up there at the PhD level and you go to a class on the philosophy of science, and they'll tell you outright, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know what's real. We don't know what's not real. We can't guarantee the results of our research. And we don't even know what part of our research is true and what part isn't. But we're going to present it as truth to the general public and tell them to lead their lives by it. Pretty bad, huh? But that's exactly what happens at the higher levels of science and philosophy. They're honest with their colleagues. You know, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're doing, but we're going to lead you anyway.